Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
To talk about crushing below or crushing above on a little baby so that you can get an intact heart or an intact lung or an intact liver for sale, there's no way to defend language like that.
If we pervert the word of God by not speaking the law just to try to get along or to coexist, we're ultimately going to miss out on the wonders of the gospel.
I think often when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we go, oh boy, forgive us our sins as we forgive others. Oh no, my sins aren't going to be forgiven. No, Luther says, stop being stupid. Look at the gospel promise.
Didgeridoo players in Iowa, love issues, etc.
I remember it was about 12, 13 years ago, it's a movie that probably might not have ever been made had it not had the star power of Mel Gibson behind it, The Passion of the Christ. And then it turned into a runaway hit, despite the fact that it had as its subject matter nothing more than, well, really, kind of the last several hours of Jesus' life before his crucifixion and his resurrection. That's all it was. It was filmed in the original language, Aramaic. Many people thought that would be a poison pill. It was made by a rather eccentric Hollywood actor, or at least since we've learned he's an eccentric, and that might have proven to be a poison pill. And it was made with relatively unknown actors. That might have proved to be a poison pill. None of them did. And maybe since, Hollywood has been searching for that magic bullet, for that Christian audience that responded so strongly and so positively to Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Greetings and welcome to a special three-hour live broadcast of Issues Etc. this Thursday afternoon, August the 25th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is going to join us to talk about a piece in The Atlantic about the new Ben-Hur movie and faith-based films. A little bit later, Pastor Hans Feeney of The Federalist will join us to talk about the cult of doomsday environmentalism. He's written about that recently. Lori Windham of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, based in Washington, D.C., will join us to talk about a legal challenge being mounted to a federal regulation that would require virtually all doctors in the U.S. to perform gender transition procedures on patients requesting it, including children. Pastor Will Whedon joins us for part three of our series, Setting the Lord's Table. We're going to talk about redeeming the time today, Christian pilgrimage through the day, week, and season, why the church marks time differently than the world. Pastor Ted Giese will join us to review that new Ben-Hur movie. And then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will round everything off at the end of those 3 hours with our series, Christ in the Old Testament. Today we'll be in Isaiah chapters 3 and 4. Our call-in number for the next 3 hours, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about a piece in The Atlantic about the new Ben-Hur movie and faith-based films, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
I'm calling it a piece because I don't know what else to call this Atlantic piece. Why are you having a hard time categorizing this thing that you read in The Atlantic about the new Ben-Hur movie?
Well, first of all, it's a subject that I am really, really interested in, which is kind of the marketplace for niche media. I mean, there was a time back in the early 90s when I almost wrote a book on a topic related to this. And I think what we're seeing here is another impact of the World Wide Web. I mean, every time we turn around, something new kind of evolves out of the World Wide Web. First of all, this could have been a news piece. It's very current. The box office failure of this movie is to some degree breaking news. So this could have been a hard news story. In fact, when I opened it up, that's what I thought it was. But then the more I read, something very strange hit me, which was there are no attributions. Anywhere in the piece, there's no indication at all where any of the information is from. And there's lots and lots of information in this piece, which means it's not a review. It's not a review of the movie at all. And it's more than just an opinion piece from someone saying, oh, by the way, this is why I didn't like the movie, or this is why I think it failed. What you keep waiting for is a journalistic mechanism that lets you know where this information's coming from. I know I said that before, but that's the key issue. And no wonder one of the dominant forces in our world today related to news industry and to the public's perception of it and the lack of trust is that media has changed so rapidly that consumers sometimes don't know what they're reading. We get notes that get religion all the time from people saying, gosh, look at this horrible article. Look how biased it is. And then you click the URL and it comes up and it's an editorial. It's meant to be biased. And then you turn around and someone says, I saw this fascinating editorial the other day that I don't agree with it, but look, take a look at it. And I call it up and I realize that's actually a news story. There's no indication, there's no flag on it, there's nothing there that tells you that this wasn't supposed to just be straight news. I was trying to create a label. What's really confusing about this is if you follow excellent magazines like The Atlantic or even Entertainment Weekly or in the old days, the classic Time and Newsweek, magazines, they would contain interpretive essays of this kind all the time. But the whole idea was that they were written after kind of like a period of reflection. There'd be at least like a two-week gap here. So now this has been going on, and now after a couple of weeks, we're going to let you know what we think is going on. Here's the story behind the story, the added depth. This thing is sitting right on top of a developing story. So I tried out these phrases. How about instant news essay or breaking news opinion? Or, what is it? And I got so obsessed with that, then I went back and read it again and realized it really is an interesting article. And it has a really interesting and very newsworthy subject in the middle of it, which made me wonder, well, why didn't they write this as a news story? Why didn't they call up some experts and quote them? And why didn't they tell us where these numbers and these opinions came from? It's really interesting and confusing.
Okay, so there are a couple of things to talk about here. Let's deal with them one at a time. First, more generally, you talked about the influence of the internet on all kinds of media, but here we're talking about the influence of the internet on journalism, where something can be written almost in real time, and it doesn't, I'm thinking blog post. What you're describing there is kind of that catch-all phrase for someone who's got some information, doesn't feel the need to attribute it, got some opinion, got some ideas that are intriguing, but none of the strictures on either scholarship or journalism. Would that be the best category?
Except this thing is so newsy. I mean, like I'm saying, that if you had gone into this and dropped in three or four attributed quotes from experts on the industry or scholars like William Romanowski at Calvin College, who's been studying this phenomena in movies for 25 years, if you had dropped in a few attributed sources, you could have plunked this baby right on the front page of a newspaper. Like I said, it's not a reflective piece. It's very with the moment and newsy. So it's like a different approach to writing news. but one in which the public really doesn't know where any of this is coming from.
The other question, that's the general one. The other one more specifically is, and you say it's intriguing, very interesting. What at the heart of this piece in The Atlantic do you find so very intriguing? What's the subject there that is not only newsworthy, but of kind of ongoing interest?
Well, you mentioned earlier that everybody's been trying to find the golden chalice of the passion demographic again. You know, they're out there looking for the Holy Grail. $611 million worth of global box office on a film that cost about $40 million or $50 million or whatever the passion cost. And that was all, I believe, Gibson funded the thing almost totally himself. So what kind of, you know, what kind of payback did he get for that? Well, nothing gets Hollywood's attention as fast as those kinds of numbers. But let's flash back before The Passion. In the early 90s, I spent a couple of days out in Hollywood interviewing people, including a couple of fairly major directors, and in one of the great disappointments of my life, my interview with Jimmy Stewart got canceled because he had the flu. I almost had a chance to interview the great Jimmy Stewart. And I was trying to find out why Hollywood struggles with subjects of religion. And in the midst of that conversation, people started talking again about technology. And what they said, they were all talking about this thing that was coming called the Internet. Now remember, 1992, 1993, that's right before the explosion of the World Wide Web in 94, 95. Now Hollywood knew what was coming. They knew something very disruptive was coming. And here's how people described it. And this will fit perfectly with the Ben-Hur case. What they said is, we think we're entering an age when, to use baseball terminology, people are going to be hitting lots of singles. Small, independent, niche market films that you make for like $30 million and you make $70 million. And you would, you know, he called that these people would refer to that as a single. But he said, but at the same time, every now and then, people are going to hit a home run. And they said the home runs are going to be what Hollywood calls event films. They cost about $100 million to make or more. You're going for the widest possible demographics. And already in the early 90s, they were starting to call these special effect films. In other words, the comic book films, the Star Wars, the Star Treks, the big, wide demographic movies that you send out there and teenagers want to see them four or five times. Male demographic 18-35 shows up. Okay? Now, this is all linked to the phenomena of religion in film, because what they were saying was, we think that Christians and even evangelical Christians have the potential to be a new Hollywood niche for singles, for indie, smaller films. A phrase that I wrote down, which I began hearing more and more as the years went by, was, born again may be the new gay. Now, do you understand what that means?
Oh, yeah.
In other words, you had gay film. You know, you had like a decade or two of small niche market gay film, and they were saying, oh my gosh, born-again evangelical Protestants might be the new gay, the new kind of insider movie, small world. You don't have to spend much on them, but they make more than enough money to be profitable, and then you just keep making them, and you have a new niche, like Latino film or children's movies or a movie for the whole family, right? All of those niches that we're familiar with. Now, Ben-Hur is fascinating because Ben-Hur is an attempt to do an event budget film with all the baggage that comes with it. I think the only thing that I can think of that would be even comparable to this from the post-Passion, we're all trying to get the magic formula right era, would be the Chronicles of Narnia films. Had big budgets. But how many other movies have they made, like Noah and, what was it, Gods and Men and all of these other things where they tried to get the whole kind of bathrobe, biblical epic thing moved into the current day? And they've all been bombs, right? I mean, almost uniformly, they've all lost big time at the box office. But here comes Ben-Hur. They're going to try again. This just intrigued me also because I truly love the 1959 Ben-Hur. I mean, I think I've watched a lot of documentaries about it with interviews with people like George Lucas and Martin Scorsese and huge directors talking about how that movie changed Hollywood forever. And it wasn't just the epic size of it or the audience or the fact that it won 11 Academy Awards. What intrigued them was, I'm trying to remember which Hollywood director that was that put it this way. It might have been George Lucas, who made the comment, it was a personal epic. Hollywood before that had made big, huge movies, but they were kind of like broad palette, big picture things. Ben-Hur, from the beginning to the end, was the story of one man for 3.5 hours. And he was complicated, and his face was bigger than life, and you followed him all the way through what now in Hollywood is called the hero's journey. Star Wars is a classic example of a hero's journey with Luke Skywalker. You've got all of these other films that are all centered on this one big, complex hero. Nobody had ever really done it before on the scale of Ben-Hur. So now they're going to try to repeat that kind of success with a movie that has an undeniable religious message. But according to this Atlantic piece, in their early plans, they really thought this movie was going to appeal to teenagers and young males and that they were going to get the action demographics in this film. And then as it became apparent they wouldn't, they pushed it in the direction of, well, let's get churches to show up. Let's get that religious demographic to show up. Except in modern America, is that a home run demographic if your name isn't Mel Gibson? I think that's the question everybody's asking.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about a piece in The Atlantic about the new Ben-Hur movie and faith-based films. On the other side of the break, we will talk about these attempts to recapture that lightning in a bottle that was The Passion of the Christ. And of course, through that, its audience, and what it is Christians are looking for. What was it that was so compelling about that and didn't prove as compelling with that niche audience about the film Ben-Hur? Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. I am Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took 5 loaves and 2 fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity, Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
How has pop American Christianity replaced the Holy Trinity with the unholy trinity of me, myself, and I? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, Has American Christianity Failed? It's written by regular guest Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. Has American Christianity Failed? Is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or find out more at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Has American Christianity Failed? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about a piece in The Atlantic about the new Ben-Hur movie and faith-based films. Terry, I'm curious of your thoughts here about why the Ben-Hur movie didn't kind of resurrect the lightning in the bottle that was The Passion of the Christ. What was it about that movie, in spite of all the things it had going against it back in 2004, Passion of the Christ? What was it about that film that did what it did with the Christian audience?
Well, first of all, we have to state right up front that having a superstar involved is crucial. Now, let's say you're the pastor of a huge Southern Baptist megachurch, or a Catholic college, or name some other major, you know, religious institution, and your phone rings one day, and you pick it up, and it's Mel Gibson. And Mel Gibson says, I know we're going to be taking something on here that's real tricky. I want to show you 80% of my unedited, rough film and get your input because I want to make sure I get the religion part right. Now, would that be an interesting call in your day?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, that's because whatever you want to think about Mel Gibson, whether you love him or hate him, when the man is on the wagon with alcohol and going to confession, he is a remarkably powerful artist. Even if you wish, like I do, that he wasn't so literalistic with his depictions of violence. I've wisecracked many times that I wish we could have the films of Mel Gibson and go back in time and let Hitchcock edit them. Could you imagine how powerful some of the Mel Gibson movies would be if the violence was stylistically handled the way Hitchcock would have done it? But anyway, I think one of the factors that we're working with here is, like it or not, celebrity matters in American society. And celebrity matters just as much to the traditional Christian, evangelical, how many minivans can you put in the parking lot audience as to any other audience in America. And let me point out what I think is the other example. And this was a film that I actually got interviewed by the Los Angeles Times, which was doing one of the many post-Passion stories about this phenomena. And this piece in the LA Times was about the success of the movie, I'm sure you'll remember it, The Blind Side.
Yes.
Now, what did The Blind Side have?
It had, can't believe I can't remember her name because it's my wife's favorite actress.
It had Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
In an Oscar-level performance, and it helps also that it had one of the two or three biggest names in all of country music playing her husband in McGraw. It had celebrity. It also was funny. It was about sports. And one person that analyzed that film, I thought, said something really important. It had sports, and at the center of it was a great story that African-American families loved. While lots of people thought it was controversial that you had this rich white family adopting this African-American boy from the hood who happened to be able to play left tackle in football, a lot of people were offended by that. There was tons of evidence that there was one group that wasn't offended by that at all, and that was the black family and church-going audience. How many movies do you know of in recent American history that you would show up at the theater and the audience would be half black and half white, and about 80% of them would have church bumper stickers on their car. That's a bigger demographic than white evangelicalism for niche films, right? But once again, it had celebrity. I've often thought people ought to go back and study the demographics for the original release of My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which was a movie that had family and to a certain degree faith in it and stuff like that. You could name some other movies that have achieved kind of moderate success, like Soul Surfer and Heaven is for Real. And if you look at these niche market, what my Hollywood experts would have called a singles film, it hit not singles like single adult, but it was a single like in baseball. It didn't cost you a lot to make, and it made like double what it cost. Even those films, Soul Surfer, Heaven is for Real, these films had marketable stars in them, maybe in smaller roles and in some bigger roles. Now, name me a huge star from the new Ben-Hur.
Can't do it.
Morgan Freeman, and he's the first voice you hear and like the last one you hear, but he's not actually at the heart of the movie. When the original Ben-Hur came out, it turned Charlton Heston into one of the biggest stars on the planet, but he was already a major box office draw. Celebrity counts. Now, how many A-list actors do we have in Hollywood that want to be a part of pretty strongly, blatantly religious films? And the answer is not a ton of them. And certainly no one of the level of Mel Gibson or Sandra Bullock or some of the others who have been a part of these successes. So I think one of the things we have to take away from this is, first of all, we have proven that there is a niche market for quality, interesting, kind of indie film style Christian work. That's been proven. That's out there. What we have not proven is short of a mega star celebrity level film. I don't think we've proven that the Christian market could hit home runs. The Passion was literally lightning in a bottle, and it was all about the world of religion in American life being approached by someone of the artistic level, the controversy level, and the celebrity level of Mel Gibson.
So, Terry, with about 30 seconds here, what's the best single piece of advice, that journalistic advice, that you can give to reporters when they write the story about faith-based films?
First of all, they need to build their Rolodex into the world of Christians who are doing serious thinking about film. I mentioned William Romanowski early. That's a great example. If we had more time, I could give you some other names. But they're out there, and there are people who genuinely love well-made film and understand the religious market. It's not just a TV religion kind of thing. And that you even have people in Hollywood who are outspoken or quietly spoken Christians who work in places like Pixar, or Scott Derrickson, the noted director of horror films, who is a very articulate Christian. If you promise to do good work and you show you can do good work, and you quote them on the record, I think these people might talk about these subjects.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to do it.
When we come back, Pastor Hans Feeney is going to join us. He has recently written a piece for The Federalist, and it's called Baby Haters Use Global Warming to Justify Their Selfishness. We're going to talk about the cult of doomsday environmentalism on this Thursday afternoon, August the 25th. Then we'll discuss a legal challenge to a federal regulation that would require doctors to perform gender transition procedures on those requesting it, including children. I'm Todd Wilkin. More Issues Etc. right after this.
The church's music from the 20th century. the 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Resurrection Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. Bethlehem Lutheran, Parma, Ohio. St. Paul's Lutheran, Lockport, Illinois. Faith Lutheran, Columbus, Indiana. Glory of Christ Lutheran, Plymouth, Minnesota. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Arnold, Missouri. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Cedar Falls, Iowa. Zion Lutheran, Moberly, Missouri. And Elm Grove Lutheran, Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.